CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Michael Auslan of the Hoover Institution, writing most recently about China, but not just China, the involvement of all the great nations in the quandary that is presented by the People's Republic of China, the aggression, the harsh words, the unhappiness, the tangle of trading relationships in the region and around the world. Michael has written about all these things, so I ask him first to help us understand how this cacophony of threats is conjoined with the ambition for everybody to maintain China as a vital geopolitical power. Michael is the author most recently of Asia's New Geopolitics, Essays on Reshaping the Indo-Pacific. That's certainly where we are. Michael, good evening to you. You begin your essay by pointing out the fact that Global Britain is deploying a warship to East Asia. I believe that Global France is also involved in the Quad, the India, Australia, Japan, and the United States in the Indo-Pacific. How do you interpret this decision by the Boris Johnson government to deploy a warship to a place far, far away? Good evening to you, Michael.
Good evening, John. Well, I think it's pretty simple. The London government has finally decided that they have to deal with the China that they have and not the China that they want. The Prime Minister just a few months ago stated that he was fervently Sinophile, meaning that he was thoroughly enamored with China. But, you know, the reality is that Britain, like all countries around the world, are having to deal with what they perceive to be threats to their own interests. And this is regardless of what's happening with the United States. And so, having concluded a major review of their security policies called the Integrated Review, Britain, for the first time since the Falklands War back in 1982, is sending not just a warship, they're sending their newest aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, but they're actually sending an entire carrier strike group, which will include a U.S. destroyer and a Netherlands ship as well. And it will also have U.S. Marine Corps F-35B fighter aircraft on board. And this is going to be a 7-month deployment or even an 8-month deployment. It will go all the way up to Japan, and then it will come back down through the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean. And it is being labeled by the British very clearly and very openly as a deployment to help uphold the international rules and norms of freedom of navigation and maritime law in the face of the challenge that China poses.
Michael, you present the mystery of this because in your essay in Foreign Policy, because we got into this over trade. That was the original discord. I believe the Trump administration is given credit or blame, depending on where you stand, for disputing China as the manufacturer of the United States and of reviving East Asia. We got into it about trade, but you've just very carefully illustrated it is now involving warships of two great seafaring nations. In fact, you point to Admiral Tony Radakin of the British Navy, the first Sea Lord, and Mike Kilday, the Chief of Naval Operations. So in the making that transition from trade, which is theoretically about container ships, to warships, what happened in between, Michael? Is there a way to understand what happened in Beijing that we went from disputing money to disputing guns?
Well, I think it's been an evolution over the past decade, and that in itself has grown out of the 4 decades of engagement between the United States and the People's Republic of China since the normalization of relations in 1979. The idea of bringing China into the global community of tapping into its economic potential is something that was the main focus of U.S. administrations through the 1970s and 80s and 1990s. And so their bet on bringing a post Mao Zedong China into the world worked. What they didn't anticipate was just how powerful that China would become, and more importantly, how it would hold very different visions of global order and its own role in this system, and how it would seek in many ways to co-opt it or undermine it or challenge it. And so that evolution from butter to guns is in some ways an outgrowth both of the fact that for decades we only looked at one real element of this relationship with China, which was the economic one, and ignored the ways in which it was growing into becoming a challenge to the international system, and that extended into questions of espionage, of intellectual property, of propaganda and intimidation campaigns, and the outright power politics of, for example, taking over territory in the South China Sea, threatening Taiwan, threatening neighbors around it.
The split between China and its neighbors, split between China and other geopolitical powers, you cite in your essay that perhaps we can date it to President Trump, the letter signed by academics, discouraged academics because of the harsh relations between China and the United States. But I can recall, Michael, and I don't remember the date, the break with Japan, and I believe there was arson at Japanese car dealerships in China, and there were parades, demonstrations, loud protests against Japan having to do with the Prime Minister of Japan visiting a shrine that in some fashion was seen to honor soldiers who committed criminal acts in China during the Second War. I can recall that split then. Was that foreshadowing? Because she wasn't in power at that point. I believe it was Hu Jintao is my memory, maybe even before. Was that a foreshadowing of where we are now? In other words, underneath everything, has there always been this tension, and we chose not to see it?
That's a great question. I think that in terms of the Japan-China case, the riots that you're referencing go back about a decade to, in fact, a territorial dispute between the two, which is still going on in the East Japan, the East China Sea, where Japan has control over a set of islands called the Senkakus. The Chinese call them the Daoyu. These were controlled by Japan before World War II, according to Japanese claims. The U.S. had some administration of them after World War II. The Japanese took them over again, and the Chinese claimed them for themselves. So it's an extremely complicated territorial dispute between the two, according to maritime law. The administration of the islands has been under the Japanese since the early 1970s, and yet as China has expanded its activities and actions throughout the near seas of East Asia, it has begun to claim these territories, just as it has done in the South China Sea, as it's done in the Paracels and the Spratly Islands. The Japanese are a much more powerful nation to deal with, and so for a decade now, these two have been jockeying over these islands, with the Chinese sending different types of fishing vessels and maritime patrol vessels and Navy vessels into those waters, and the Japanese countering with the Japanese Coast Guard and sometimes even the Japanese Navy. That translated that tension into broader historical disputes between the two that had been a separate issue over the visits to the shrine. You mentioned the Yasukuni Shrine in Tokyo, where there are 18 Class A war criminals enshrined, over questions about Japanese portrayal of World War II in its history textbooks, and Chinese nationalism was deployed by Beijing in these riots to attack the Japanese embassy, to attack Japanese car dealerships and factories. But both sides also knew that they needed to pull back because of the economic integration between them. And that's exactly the nub of the problem that other nations around the world face with China, is that because of this economic integration, they are hamstrung in certain ways from dealing with the challenges to their security or in fact economic interests such as intellectual property rights from China. So there are different ways in which these tensions are played out. You have demonstrations against different countries. You, of course, have the Wolf Warrior diplomacy. You have Chinese propaganda campaigns around the world. And the new era of China relations with the world that we are in, which, you know, some date back to 2017 or so, is precisely because the nature of this challenge has become too strong to ignore. It was ignored for decades because everybody wanted to trade with China. Everybody wanted the benefits from China. Now they're recognizing not only some of the costs of doing that, but of actual threats to their interests. In the case of Japan, the Senkakus. The U.S. plays a unique role in not having, you know, territory that's disputed with China in the region, but in having not only close relations but outright security alliances with a number of the nations, including the Philippines and Japan, that have these disputes with China. And therefore, America trying to figure out how it maintains relations with China while supporting international law and supporting its allies and partners.
What we have then is a tangle that's evolved over these last years. I would say the last 10 years are critical here. And Michael's written about how we got into this mess. Now, what is to be done when we come back? The essay is turns on warships going to East Asia, but it also turns on all of the neighborhood aroused and sometimes confrontationally aroused, quite independent of the U.S. Michael Austin, author of Asia's New Geopolitics, Essays on Reshaping the Indo-Pacific. He's a fellow at the Stanford University's Hoover Institution. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Michael Austin, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, the author of Asia's New Geopolitics, Essays on Reshaping the Indo-Pacific, is taking us into the quandary that is the People's Republic of China in a new essay at Foreign Policy. And what is to be done is always the exciting question. Michael, if I understand, there's not one thing. It's a gathering of eagles. Let me put it that way. The confrontation with Australia, the confrontation with Japan, we've illustrated the confrontation with India and the Himalayas. All of these things are moving the nations what appear to be in one direction. We've already talked about Britain. France is participating in exercises in the Indo-Pacific with the Quad. Do you measure that individually these acts of pushback are having an effect in Beijing, or are they too disconnected for Beijing to pay attention?
That's an interesting question, and I think it's too early to tell at this point how Beijing will react in the aggregate. I think the point that I wanted to make, and I think it's an important point, is that there are a lot of voices that are blaming the United States for worsening relations with China. And they're not just Chinese voices. There are voices in the United States and in Europe and in other places that say it's all Donald Trump's fault, or now it's all Joe Biden's fault, that the U.S. is pursuing confrontation with China. If that were the case, then I think if it were simply the U.S. somehow wanting to have a fight with China, then I think you would see nations around the world not only distance themselves from the United States, but actively oppose those dangerous U.S. policies and try, in fact, to engage more with China to keep the peace. The reality is that from Europe throughout Asia, nations are waking up to what they perceive to be threats to their interests from Beijing that are completely separate from what's going on between the United States and China. It has nothing to do with the United States, what's going on in the South China Sea or the East China Sea. The fact that Britain is sending an aircraft carrier to Asia, to the South China Sea, has, in essence, nothing to do with the United States. It's about China, and it's about nations waking up to what the China that they have as opposed to the China that they want. And so I think it's important to counter the voices that are saying it's the U.S. that is being reckless. If that were the case, we wouldn't see all these other nations region attempt to protect their own interests, and that's really what's going on.
Australia, a special case here. Australia has prospered these decades because its natural resources are greatly a benefit to the revival of China, to its manufacturing hub. And yet the words towards Australia, Michael, have reached into a science fiction zone. There's an article, and who knows when it comes out, Global Times, of quotes saying we'll launch a ballistic missile at Australia if it fights back in some fashion. Australia is encouraging its people to understand this is a trading partner that is also a threat, and therefore I believe there's new money being poured into the Australian Navy. Australia is part of the Quad. Is that case helpful to understand how to respond to China's aggression, that pushback, that blunt pushback by Australia?
John, Australia is on the front lines, and it deserves an enormous amount of support from the United States and from other allied countries. It has taken the lead in banning foreign money, but in this case, the aim was China, Chinese money from its political system. It has banned Huawei and ZTE from its 5G networks. It has called repeatedly for independent international investigations into the COVID pandemic that began in Wuhan, China, and it has paid the price with the Chinese launching economic warfare against a raft of Australian exports, beef, wine, lobster, timber, and the like. Wine exports, for example, from Australia to China dropped from over $160 million in 2019 to $1 million in 2020. This is an example of the type of economic pressure, the economic warfare that China will bring against countries that it finds itself in disputes with. In fact, just this week, we saw it warning Bangladesh that if Bangladesh joined any Quad initiatives, the Quad again being Australia, Japan, U.S., and India, any Quad initiatives, including vaccine diplomacy or anything, that there would be damage to its relationship. So we see this policy approach from Beijing being deployed against stronger countries as well as weaker countries. And what Beijing doesn't like to see, for example, is the Quad grouping getting more active, and that's something that the Biden administration should be congratulated for and should be encouraged to do more of. And in fact, think then about how the Quad may interact with smaller countries such as Bangladesh and larger out-of-region countries like the UK. To your question earlier, is any of this having an effect on Beijing's calculations? The more that nations around the region unite, not behind the U.S., but unite because of their own individual national interests in protecting themselves, protecting their intellectual property, their trade relations, or even their territory, the more that they unite both rhetorically and actually, the more that should be sending signals to Beijing that it is picking a fight with the wider world, and that is going fundamentally to change its relations with the world.
Leverage. Is there leverage? I note, Michael, the genocide, that's the word the State Department and the Foreign Ministry in London have used about the Beijing treatment of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. That has brought a large, large protest and pushback from Beijing, because there may be a debate about the Olympics in 2022. Also, the scolding burns apparently in Beijing. I don't want to do psychology. I want to know whether you believe that pushback, being critical, being careful, banning items coming out of Xinjiang, is that having an effect in Beijing?
It doesn't seem to be yet. The policies certainly in Xinjiang have not changed. The policies that have destroyed freedom in Hong Kong over the past year have not changed. The policies in the South China Sea have not changed. In fact, we have right now a standoff between the Philippines and China in what's called the Whitsun Reef, which is in the South China Sea. It's a strategically located reef where China has brought in initially hundreds of fishing vessels and still has them throughout the area and still has a number of vessels in the reef, essentially to stake its claim, even though it's owned and administered by the Filipinos. So right now, we don't see a change, but that leverage is important. One thing that we could do in terms of leverage is something akin to an economic Article 5 in our treaties with allies such as Australia, which would be to say that if you find yourself facing economic warfare or economic pressure from Beijing, we will step in to fill the gap so you will not have any negative economic consequences. The Biden administration has continued freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. That's very important. It also has sent ships into the general region of the Whitsun Reef. There's only so much that any of the nations can do before coming up to, a red line, which could cause outright conflict with China. And that is something that the Filipinos themselves are having to figure out how far they're going to go. The Japanese are trying to figure that out with the Senkakus, but the United States as well. I think what you have to do to begin with is a lot of the things that we're doing, but you have to maintain it, which is stating very clearly what your interests are, what the regional interests are, how you'll be working with partners, and not backing down in the face of Chinese intimidation and Chinese pressure.
Michael Austin, he is the author, most recently, of Asia's New Geopolitics, Essays on Reshaping the Indo-Pacific, writing presciently about where we are now then. We will attend to Taiwan another day. Michael has also written very carefully about the threat to Taiwan represented by the mainland. But for now, writing in Foreign Policy about China and its confrontation with the world. The world. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.